Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Tales to Terrify, Crime City Central, Protecting Project Pulp, and the all-new Far-Fetched Fables. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is the Starship Sova, everybody. Welcome, hello and welcome to show 354. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello everyone, I hope everyone is fine and dandy. We have got a story. Oh, James Morrow, The Iron Shroud, that's what we're playing today. And it's a little, it's not science fiction, it's a little bit dark, a little bit horror, a little bit almost steampunk-ish, but when it comes to James Morrow, he's honestly one of my favourite writers. Each word is just carefully crafted. And I have a little interview before that as well with James. So I do hope you will stick around and enjoy this show. I'll give you just a quick bio, and actually we talk about this story in the interview that I do. But James Morrow's loopy historical novel, Galapagos Regained, will see publication in January 2015. In the spirit of The Last Witchfinder, which chronicled the coming of Enlightenment, this epic dramatised the birth of the evolution worldview. His heroine, Chloe Bathurst, gets a job as Charles Dickens' zookeeper in 1848, well before the publication of On the Origin of Species. Eventually, she finds herself in South America heading for the Galapagos Archipelago so she can collect her own evolutionary miragini and thus win the Great God Contest, 10,000 to the first entrant who can prove or disprove the existence of God. And like I say, I mentioned this story in the interview, or James does, and we just can't wait for it to come out. So over the years, we've played a couple or three stories by James Morrow, and that's when I actually first got introduced to James Morrow and his kind of writing. And we first came out with, ages ago, Lady Witherspoon's Solution. You'll have to go back and find it. Then we played Bigfoot in the Bonavistas, and then The Raft of the Titanic, and just that just sealed the deal with me with James Morrow. And I just love his work, man. His work's just so crafted. It's just fantastic. And the ideas, the quirky ideas he's got. And like I say, we've had this story there and I was just dying to get it up on the air as well. So that's fantastic. I'll do a little interview now. And then what I'll do is just go straight in to the story, James Morrow's story. So James, thank you so much for coming on Starship Sofa.
You're very welcome, Tony. It's great to return to your amazing magic vehicle.
Well,
it looks so much like a couch.
Yes. Well, it's lovely because you've been on Starship Sofa throughout the years of its kind of conception, you know, and we've got a story going to play now, Iron Shroud. And James, just if you don't mind, give it without giving too much away the kind of the secret source of the story. Tell us, you know, how you came to write Iron Shroud.
there was a ghost story anthology in the works at the American publisher HarperCollins. I was not invited to participate in the project, which was no problem as far as I'm concerned, because I'm not known as a horror writer. I rarely deal with the supernatural, at least not the supernatural taken at face value. So it didn't offend me that they they didn't ring me up. But at a certain point in the evolution of Ghosts by Gaslight, that's the title of the anthology. At a certain point in its evolution, they wanted to be able to pitch it, promote it to the world as a steampunk compendium, because the word steampunk had such cachet a couple of years ago, and I think it's still a going enterprise. But 2-3 years ago when the book appeared, if you could possibly slap the word steampunk on an anthology, I think the sales would automatically double. And they said, well, who do we know who's kind of loony and loopy enough to write a ghost story that would also have what on first principles might be an incompatible element of Victorian science? And Jack Dan and Nick Giever said, I'll bet James Morrow could bring that off. We'll invite him into the book, and we'll give him the first slot in the anthology as long as there is simultaneously the supernatural and rationalism. The Iron Shroud tells of a mad scientist who has captured the souls of the deceased in metal sheaths. And what is so horrible about his project, his obsession, is that he turns them into his servants. He calls them golems. And these electroplated specters become his private army. He mistreats them. He has absolutely no compassion for them. He is the ultimate demonic deity in their lives, and forces them to make a religion out of he himself. So there's the usual James Morrow sardonic religious satire going on in the Iron Shroud. I should also add that the title is an allusion to a very obscure story that apparently influenced Edgar Allan Poe in the composition of The Pit and the Pendulum. I believe it's a Russian story, either that or a Russian scholar that I know about identified this. It's a story about someone trapped in a room where the walls are coming together to crush him. And so Poe took this idea and incorporated it into The Pit and the Pendulum. So with that thematic energy, I went to town and wrote a ghost story. Well, my first, really.
Oh, well, that's what, James, where, if we were, and I don't even think there's an answer to this one, where could we pigeonhole James Morrow? You know, what kind of writer are you?
Well, I suppose I would prefer to have on my tombstone satirist, or perhaps even philosophical novelist, rather than science fiction writer. Now, by that remark, I don't mean to demean the genre, but it's kind of an autobiographical fact that I did not enter the field as a fan of it. I did not read a whole lot of science fiction as a kid. Inevitably, the icons drew my attention, The War of the Worlds and other books by Wells, and I read a few Robert Heinlein juveniles. But when I realized that I had in hand an idea for a novel that was a utopian satire about a pacifist world where no one has ever been robbed or raped or killed, and this morphed into my novel, The Wine of Violence, I realized that I was telling a science fiction story. And while the publisher entertained briefly a notion of marketing it as mainstream, they made, I think, an astute decision to label it science fiction. So I regard myself as having in my possession the amazing toolkit of the SF genre, robots and time travel and the possibility of visiting other planets, all of those ways that we get perspective on our society. But I see myself as much more a social critic, a satirist of the contemporary who uses the science fiction toolkit.
You know, what I love about you, Jim, is when you kind of read the stories, you know, from a reader's perspective, you get so involved and in depth. You know, when from your point of view, you know, when you're writing these stories, because it feels like every word has been pondered about to put it in that story. Is it like that for you, or does it just kind of flow from the pen or from the keyboard? Or are you really, you know, taking your time and just slotting them special words in to make a story?
Well, I do derive enormous pleasure from the rewriting process. So to answer your question, it's the latter. It is not anguishing, but it's a major time sink. It does not flow from my pen, to use your image, Tony. But that said, I almost feel sorry for writers for whom the rewriting process and the noodling with sentences is not the supreme pleasure. For me, it is ecstasy to sit down in a coffee house with the manuscript of a work in progress and just noodle with it and try to find, to use Voltaire's famous locution, le mot juste, le mot le plus juste, you know, the most perfect word possible. Coincidentally, The Iron Shroud was written in coffee houses in Prague.
And hence the
Kafka influence and the presence of creatures in the story who I call golems. But it happened that I was invited in 2010 to the International Tolstoy Conference at Yasnaya Polyana, where I gave a paper about Tolstoy. My wife and I decided to come back in slow motion. We stopped off in Poland and we stopped off in the Czech Republic. And it was in Prague that I found time to sit down and compose the first draft of this story. I just reread it, knowing that this interview with you was pending. So speaking to the issue of language, I was pleased with a number of the metaphors that I came up with, and I do struggle.
You don't want to change anything, do you?
I do struggle.
When you reread it.
To make it as musical and poetic as possible. There are moments where I said, oh my God, this is overwriting. If I ever publish the story, I will strike a couple of the phrases that border on the purple. But I was pretty pleased with it, I must say.
Jim, can you leave? Do you know when the story's finished, or is it never finished?
Well, that's a good question. I know there are playwrights who never regard the printed text of the play as the last word, and they will often rewrite it every time they hear that there's a new production in the works. And I like to think that in the age of digitalization, that works are never completely settled. They're always in a state of becoming. I can't imagine reprinting The Iron Shroud or any of my other stories for a James Morrow collection without noodling with it just a little bit more. You know, they're always in a state of flux. Wouldn't want to noodle with it to the degree that I was sort of cheating the readers who had encountered an earlier draft and presumably taken some pleasure in it. That wouldn't be fair to them. Now you have to buy the director's cut of your favorite movie because it's supposedly even better than what you read. Wouldn't want to play that game, but I'm sufficiently neurotic, and as I say, it's ecstasy for me to just play around with sentences.
Have you ever, Jim? Have you ever just took it too far? You know, with your, in your kind of words, noodling, and you went, I've lost this. It all went pear shaped.
I suppose there is such a thing as fixing a story that isn't really broken. But I have to say, and I don't know if this is a vain comment or a modest comment, I don't think I've ever over rewritten a story. I think I can't say, oh, I wish I had gone back and could restore something that I'd composed that was simpler, less baroque, you know. Give me the grand manner every time.
Jim, do you mind if we go back in history then? Let's talk about, if you don't mind, your childhood. I'm fascinated at where you grew up and, you know, what your childhood was like.
Well, I'm often asked whether I had a strict religious upbringing and that possibly the atheist argument, the rationalist argument that's running through all of my fiction maybe traces to my having been assaulted by a nun with a ruler or some equivalent trauma at the hands of institutionalized religion. No, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, born into a household of a mom and a dad, no siblings. I'm an only child. My parents had a kind of nominal belief in God, or just a sort of a perfunctory notion that there's a mystery to the universe, and with any luck, one acquires a ticket to heaven that one eventually then cashes in. But they decided, I think they had a kind of inoculation theory with their child, that if I were given a small dose of religion, that would protect me from coming down with a really bad case of religion. So they took me to a very bland Presbyterian church in the next town over, the First Presbyterian Church of Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. And I would say it worked. I didn't ever walk into the house and say, Mom and Dad, I've decided to become a monk. You know, Mom and Dad, Jesus is now the center of my life and I intend to take holy orders. I came away with a minimalist, barely functional, nebulous notion of a supreme being. And this evaporated when I began to read writers like Kafka and Camus and Voltaire, the great skeptics. I was introduced to all of them in one amazing world literature class that I had in 10th grade at Abington Senior High School, supervised by an amazing instructor named James Giordano. And I never looked back after that. That was sort of my inverse road to Damascus. Once I discovered that there was such a thing as skepticism, such a thing as authors who rejected the received wisdom of their time and of their place, and who invited us to revel in the mystery of it all and not settle for the answers of politicians and clerics. Sign me up, I said. I'm going to do this myself one day. I'm going to, in my own modest way, follow in the footsteps of Camus and Voltaire and these French atheists.
Was school a happy place for you then, Jim?
I guess thinking over our theme of my obsession with detail. I probably made myself unnecessarily unhappy trying to get good grades in all of my classes. So I managed to overwork myself beyond what my teachers expected of me. I'm a great defender of public schools, though. I think they're one of the best ideas people ever had. The Republican Party at the moment is doing everything it can think of to destroy public education in this country, underfunding the public schools, promoting private religious schools, providing parents with vouchers to send their kids to places like this. So that makes me very sad. If it had not been for the cosmopolitan quality of my high school, for that amazing world literature class, I would not be the person I am today. James Giordano just opened up the minds of all of his students. So in that regard, I was a happy student, discovering these universes that I never knew existed, you know, that the universe that you would never get a clue about in a Presbyterian Sunday school, from watching television or from just the general discourse in the popular culture.
When did you discover then, Jim, about, you know, trying to get yourself published, you know, to maybe make a profession of it?
Well, I did not come out of high school saying, I'll bet it's really easy to write novels for a living. That's what I'll do. I didn't even come out of college with any definite notions of trying to become a man of letters. I became a classroom teacher. I had majored in fiction writing at the University of Pennsylvania, my alma mater. But in those days, we're talking about casting our minds back to 1969. In those days, there was very little sense at universities that fiction making was teachable, that there were skills, both aesthetic and political, that one could impart to a nascent writer that would enable him or her to have a career. It was nothing more than sitting around with the professor and doing a workshop, critiquing each other's manuscripts. But there was no rigorous or systematic instruction in point of view or sentence rhythm or all of the. I think what are in fact the teachable skills, the craft of writing, the sorts of things you could learn several years later, maybe by going to one of the workshops, such as most conspicuously Iowa. But one day, I just found myself in possession of the idea I mentioned earlier, my novel, The Wine of Violence, a pacifist utopia. And a plot centered on the mystery of how in the world did such a blessed state descend upon these people living on another planet. Turns out that they indulge in catharsis. They watch television all day, and they can directly hook themselves up to their television receivers and control the content and indulge in the most extremely violent fantasies that come out of their own lives. If the boss has been mean to you during the day, you can switch on your TV and see yourself decapitating your boss. And this has such a cathartic effect that you feel no impulse to commit that crime in real life. So anyway, I was very taken with this idea, managed to find a literary agent, managed to find a good hardcover publisher in New York, and then I immediately became addicted to fiction making. And I was fulfilling the contract that I'd written with myself back in 10th grade, back in the year 1963, I guess it was, to try to write novels of ideas, to try to use that satiric idiom I'd learned from Voltaire and and Mark Twain and create my own novels with that voice.
And are you still, Jim, as excited what you are now, you know, were then that you are now, you know, because I know you've got a new book out, The Madonna and the Starship. Does it still get you, this writing?
I love it more than ever. And in that regard, I consider myself one of the luckiest people I know. You know, I'm not a celebrity. I'm not famous. I don't have sales in the bestseller category. But I couldn't be more satisfied. The Madonna and the Starship continues this obsession of mine with God and the problems of playing God. As your listeners will discover, the theme of the Iron Shroud is the horror of someone who presumes to play God, someone who takes these ghosts, these electroplated spirits, turns them into golems who will do his bidding. I've got a novel on the runway. It's called Galapagos Regained, about the coming of the Darwinian worldview. I sent you a paragraph about it, summarizing
right,
the plot.
Yes.
So you can read that as part of as your introduction to me, I guess.
So is that, Jim, is that one kind of, when you say on the runway, is that one finished, ready to be at the printers, or are we still waiting? Will there be a few more tweaks and turns on the drafts?
It's finished, and it will appear in January of next year from St. Martin's Press here in the U.S., and we don't yet have a U.K. publisher, but presumably someone will line up in your country if the book gets good reviews here in the U.S.
So, Jim, what – is there anything – you know, like the short stories, because that's our kind of bread and butter, the short stories. Are they like nice little sweet treats for you to kind of slot in between your novels, or – are they just as important, you know, for you writing the short fiction?
Well, I'd have to say, in all honesty, my heart is in the novel. I've always been attracted to epic, I guess, in literature and in cinema. So, to a large degree, the short stories provide me with a respite between the heavy lifting that each novel seems to entail, the philosophical heavy lifting of a novel such as The Last Witchfinder, where I had to learn everything I could about Isaac Newton and the emergence of mechanical science and how that presented a challenge to the Renaissance demon-driven world picture that occasioned ultimately the witch courts. And in the case of Galapagos Regained, had having to spend many, many hours researching Victorian England and South America during Darwin's time. The plot involves a kind of Jules Verne-esque adventure. My heroine, who is Darwin's zookeeper, hired to tend the menagerie he brought back from the Galapagos archipelago, which he didn't really do, by the way. That's my poetic license talking. But she's hired to tend his menagerie and has reason to recapitulate that same menagerie, to gather together the same specimens by betaking herself to Galapagos. She has to do that by way of South America. So I had to research what that continent was like circa 1848, found out about the rubber trade and the destructive impact that had on the native population. She finally does get to Galapagos, and by rounding up all these specimens that illustrate the theory of natural selection, she hopes she will win the great God contest back in Oxford. 10,000 pounds to the first scholar or sage or philosopher or theologian who can prove or disprove the existence of God. Heavy stuff. So, yes, the short stories are sort of a treat for me, a way to relax.
Jim, I'm looking forward to that one coming out as well. Let's hope you get a UK publisher sorted out as soon as possible for that one.
Thank you. I hope so.
Jim, it's been lovely because I know you've got to shoot off now and do some babysitting there for the grandkids.
Yeah, I have twin grandsons and they're demanding my attention right now. But this has been great. Let's do it again soon.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, I mean, hopefully when your Madonna and the Starship, not that one, the one that's coming out on the runway, hopefully when that comes out, you know, we'll try and get you back on and, you know, it'll be lovely to have a chat, see how that's going.
Absolutely. Looking forward.
Jim, thank you so much. So, the Starship Sova is very proud to present.
The Iron Shroud by James Morrow. Jonathan Hobwright cannot discourse upon the formic thoughts that flicker through the minds of ants. And he is similarly ignorant concerning the psyches of locusts, toads, moles, apes, and bishops. But he can tell you what it's like to be in hell. The abyss has become his fixed abode. Perdition is now his permanent address. Although Jonathan's eyes deliver only muddy and monochromatic images, his ears have acquired an uncommon acuity. Encapsulated head to toe in damnation's carapace, he can hear the throbbing heart of a nearby rat, the caw of a proximate raven, the hiss of an immediate snake. Not only is the abyss acoustically opulent, it is temporally egalitarian. Here, every second is commensurate with a minute, every minute with an hour, every hour with an eon. Has he been immured for a week? A month? A year? Is he reciting to himself the 10th successive account of his incarceration? The 100th? The 1,000th? Listen carefully, Jonathan Hobwright. Attend to every word emerging from the gossamer gates of your phantom mouth. Perhaps on this retelling, you will discover some reason not to abandon hope. Even in hell, stranger things have happened. It is at the funeral of his mentor and friend, the illustrious Alistair Wolmeth, that Jonathan meets the woman whose impeccable intentions are to become the paving stones on his road to perdition. By the terms of Dr. Wolmeth's last will and testament, the service is churchless and austere. A graveside gathering in St. Sepulchre's Cemetery, Oxford, not so very far from Wadham College, where Wolmeth wrought most of his scientific breakthroughs. Per the dead man's prescription, the party is limited to his one true protégé, Jonathan, plus his valet, his beloved but dull-witted sister, his three most promising apprentices, and the Right Reverend Mr. Torrance. As the vicar mutters the incantation by which an Englishman once again becomes synonymous with ashes and dust, the mourners contemplate the corpse. Dr. Wolmeth's earthly remains lie within an open coffin suspended above the grave, its oblong form casting a jagged shadow across the cavity, like the gnomon on an immense sundial. The inscription on the stone is singularly spare. A. F. Wolmeth, 1803-1881. To assert that Alistair Wolmeth was a latter-day Prometheus would not, on Jonathan's view, distort the truth. Just as the mythic Titan stole fire from the gods, so did Wolmeth appropriate from nature some of her most obscure principles, transforming them into his own private science, the nascent sphere of knowledge he called vibratology. This new field was for its discoverer a fundamentally esoteric realm, to be explored in a manner reminiscent of the ancient Pythagoreans practicing their cultish geometry. Of course, when the outside world realized that Walmeth Quest had yielded a practical invention, a tuning fork capable of cracking the thickest crystal and pulverizing the strongest metal, the British Society of Engineers urged him to patent the device and establish a corporation dedicated to its commercial exploitation. One particularly aggressive BSE member, a demolitions expert named Cardigan, wanted to market the Walmeth resonator as an earthquake in a satchel case, a miraculous implement auguring a day when the dredging of canals, the blasting of mines, the shattering of battlements, and the moving of mountains will be accomplished with the wave of a wand. To Dr. Walmeth's eternal credit, or so Jonathan constructed the matter, he resisted all such blandishments. Until the day he died, Walmeth forbade his disciples to discuss the resonator in any but the most opaque mathematical terms, confining the conversation to quarterlies concerned solely with theoretical harmonics. The technical periodicals, meanwhile, remained as bereft of articles about the tuning fork as they did of lyric poetry. Contrary to Walmeth's wishes, a ninth mourner has appeared at the service, a parchment-skinned crone in a black hooded mantle. Her features, Jonathan notes, partake as much of the geological as the anatomical. Her brow is a crag, her nose a promontory, her lower lip a protuberant shelf of rock. With impassive eyes she watches while the sexton, a nimble scarecrow named Foot, leans over the open coffin and, in accordance with the deceased genius's desires, lays a resonator on the frozen bosom, wrapping the stiff fingers around the shank, so that in death Dr. Walmeth assumes the demeanour of a sacristan clutching a broom-sized crucifix. An instant later the sexton's assistants, the blockish Garber and the scrawny Osmond, set the lid on the coffin and nail it in place. Foot works the windlass, lowering Walmeth to his final resting place. Taking up their spades, Garber and Osmond return the dirt whence it came, the clods striking the coffin lid with percussive thumps, even as the crone approaches Jonathan.
"Dr. Hobright, I presume?"
she says in a viscous German accent.
"Vibratologist extraordinaire?"
Not nearly so extraordinaire as Alistair Walmeth. Reaching into her canvas sack, the crone produces the January, April and July issues of Oscillation Dynamics for 1879.
"But you published articles in all these, yeah?"
"It was a good year for me," Jonathan replies, nodding. "No fewer than 5 of my projects came to fruition."
"But 1881 will be even better."
The crone's voice suggests a corroded piccolo played by a consumptive.
"Before the month is out, you will bring peace and freedom to a myriad unjustly imprisoned souls."
From her sack, she withdraws a leather-bound volume inscribed with the words, "Journal of Baron Gustav Nachstein."
"I am Countess Helga Nachstein. 30 years ago I gave birth to the author of this confession, my beloved Gustav, destined for an untimely end. More untimely even than the fate of his father, killed in a duel when Gustav was only 10.
"My heart goes out to you," Jonathan says. The Countess sighs extravagantly, doubling the furrows of her crenellated brow.
"The sins of the sons are visited on the mothers. Please believe me when I say that Gustav Nachstein was as brilliant a scientist as your Dr. Walmeth. Alas, his investigations took him to a dark place, and in consequence many innocent beings have spent the past 11 years locked in an earthly purgatory. Just when I'd begun to despair of their liberation, I happened upon my son's collection of scientific periodicals. The fact that the inventor of the Walmeth resonator is no longer among the living has not dampened my expectations, for I assume you can lay your hand on such a machine and bear it to the site of the tragedy?"
"Perhaps."
"As consideration, I can offer 1,000 English pounds. The Countess presses her son's diary into Jonathan's uncertain grasp. Open his journal to the entry of August the 6th, 1870, and you will find an initial payment of 200 pounds, plus the first-class railway tickets that will take you from London to Freiburg to the village of Tübenhausen, and from there to Castle Kralkovnik in the Schwarzwald. May I assume that a week will suffice for you to put your affairs in order? Cracking the spine of the Baron's journal, Jonathan retrieves an envelope containing the promised banknotes and train tickets. I must confess, Countess, I am perplexed by your presumption. He glances toward the grave, noting that the crater is now sealed. The mourners linger beside the mound, each locked in contemplations doubtless ranging from cherished memories of Dr. Walmouth to wonderment over who among them will next feel the reaper's scythe, to curiosity concerning the location of the nearest public house. Does it not occur to you that I may have better things to do with my time than extirpating your son's transgressions? By way of reply, the Countess produces from her sack a tinted daguerreotype of a young woman. I am not the only one to experience remorse over Gustav's imprudence. My granddaughter Lotta is also in pain, tormented by her failure to warn her father away from his project. Having recently extricated herself from an ill-advised engagement, she is presently in residence at the castle. The thought of meeting the renowned Dr. Hopwright has fired her with an anticipation bordering on exhilaration. Jonathan spends the remainder of the afternoon in the Queen's Lane coffee house, perusing the Baron's confession. Shortly after 4 o'clock, he finishes reading the last entry, then slams the volume closed. If this fantastic chronicle can be believed, then the evil that Gustav Nackstein perpetrated was of so plenary an intensity as to demand his immediate intervention. He will go to the Black Forest, bearing a tuning fork and collateral voltaic piles. He will redeem the damned souls of Castle Kralkovnik. But even if their plight had not stirred Jonathan, the case would still entail two puissant facts. 1,000 pounds is the precise sum by which a competent vibratologist might continue Dr. Walmer's work on a scale befitting its worth, and never in his life has Jonathan beheld a creature so lovely as Fräulein Lotta Nackstein. 15th of March, 1868. After many arduous years of research into the dubious science of spiritualism, I have reached 6 conclusions concerning so-called ghosts. 1. There is no great beyond, no stable realm, where carefree phantoms gamble while awaiting communiques from turban-topped clairvoyants sitting in candlelit parlours surrounded by the dearly departed's loved ones. Show me a medium, and I'll show you a mountebank. Give me a filament of ectoplasm, and I'll return a strand of taffy. 2. There is life after death. 3. Once a spectre has elected to vacate its fleshly premises, no ordinary barrier of stone or metal will impede its journey. A willful phantom can easily escape a pharaoh's tomb, a potentate's mausoleum, or a lead casket buried 6 feet underground. 4. With each passing instant, yet another quantum of a spectre's incorporeal substance scatters in all directions. Once dissipated, a ghost can never reassemble itself. The post-mortem condition is evanescent in the extreme, not to be envied by anyone possessing an iota of joie de vivre. 5. Despite the radical discontinuity between the two planes, a spectre may, under certain rare circumstances, access the material world prior to total dissolution. Hence the occasional credible account of a ghost performing a boon for the living. A deceased child places her favourite doll on her mother's dresser. A departed suitor posts a letter declaring eternal devotion to his beloved. A phantom dog barks one last time,
warning his master away from a bridge on the point of collapse. 6. In theory, a competent scientist should be able at the moment of death to encapsulate a person's spectral shade in some spiritually impermeable substance, thus cancelling the dissipation process and creating a kind of immortal soul. The question I intend to explore may be framed as follows. Do the laws of nature permit the synthesis of an alloy so dense as to trap an emergent ghost, yet sufficiently pliant, that the creature will be free to move about? 17th of May, 1868. For the past 2 months, I have not left my laboratory. I am surrounded by the music of science, burbling flasks, bubbling retorts, moaning generators, humming rectifiers. Von Helmholtz, Mendeleev and the rest, my alleged peers, will doubtless aver that my quest partakes more of a discredited alchemy than a tenable chemistry. When I go to publish my results, they'll insist with a sneer I would do better submitting the paper to the Proceedings of the Paracelsus Society than to the Cambridge Journal of Molecularism. Let the intellectual midgets have their fun with me. Let the ignoramuses scoff. Where angels fear to tread, Baron Nackstein rushes in. And one day the dead will extol him for it. If all goes well, by this time tomorrow I shall be holding in my hand a lump of the vital material. I intend to call it Bezalelite, in honour of Judah Löwe ben Bezalel, the medieval rabbi from Prague, who fashioned a man of clay, giving the creature life by incising on its brow the Hebrew word emeth, that is, truth. Although Judah Löwe's golem was a faithful servant and protector of the ghetto, the rabbi was naturally obliged to prevent it from working on the Sabbath, a simple matter of effacing the first letter of emeth, the aleph, leaving mem and tor, characters that spell meth, death. But one fateful Friday evening, Löwe forgot to disable his brainchild. In consequence of this inadvertent sacrilege, the golem ran amok all day Saturday, and so, come Sunday, the heartsick rabbi dutifully ground the thing to dust. I shall not lose control of my golems. From the moment they come into the world, they will know who is the puppet and who the puppeteer, who the beast and who the keeper, who the slave and who the master. 9th July, 1868. At long last, following a deliriously eventful June, I have found time to again take pen in hand. Not only did I fashion the essential alloy, not only did I learn how to produce it in quantities commensurate with my ambitions, but I have managed to coat living tissue with thin and malleable layers of the stuff. Naturally, I first tested the adhesion process on animals. After many false starts and innumerable failures, I managed to electroplate a wasp, a moth, a dragonfly, a frog, a serpent, a tortoise, and a cat, successfully trapping their spirits as a concomitant suffocation deprived them of their lives. In every case, the challenge was to find an optimum rate at which to replenish the Bezalelite anode with fresh quantities of the alloy. If I introduced too many positively charged atoms into the bath, then the cathode, that is, the experimental vertebrate or invertebrate, invariably suffered paralysis. Too few such ions, and the chrysalis became so porous as to allow the soul's egress. I was pleased and surprised by how quickly a plated spectre learns to move. Within hours of its emergence from the electrolyte solution, each subject variously flew, hopped, slithered, crawled, or ran, as adeptly as when alive. To the best of my knowledge, a ghost's condition entailed...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
...only one deficit. Because the olfactory sense is actually heightened by the procedure, the creature will undergo a highly unpleasant interval as its former corporeal host decays within the chrysalis. Once decomposition is complete, however, the encapsulated phantom is free to revel in its immortality. Finding an experimental subject of the species Homo sapiens posed no difficulties. 3 months ago, my manservant Wolfgang was diagnosed with a cancer of the stomach. His anguish soon proved as unimaginable as the physician's palliatives proved useless. The instant I proposed to sever his tormented soul from his ravaged flesh, he surrendered himself to my science. I shall not soon forget the sight of Wolfgang's glazed body rising from the wooden vat. Eyeless, noseless, mouthless, hairless. The solution had plated all his features, much as an enormous candle burning atop a bust will, drip by drip, sheathe the face in wax. In a single deft gesture, I removed the breathing pipe and, taking up a permanent basalolite plug, stoppered the ventilation hole, so that death by asphyxiation occurred in a matter of minutes. Even as the waters of Wolfgang's rebirth sluiced along his arms and cascaded down his chest, he began teaching his phantom limbs to animate the chrysalis, his phantom eyes to pierce the translucent husk, and so he climbed free of the tar-lined tub without misadventure. The gaslight caught the hardened elixir, causing cold sparks to flash among the bulges and pits. A naive witness happening upon my golem would have taken him for a knight clad in armour fashioned from phosphorescent brass and polished amber. "The pain is gone," the ghost reported. "Naturally," I replied. "I have disembodied you. Henceforth your name is Nonentity 101. "I can barely see," he moaned. "A necessary and, as you will soon realise, trivial side effect. I feel buried alive. Set me free, Herr Dr. Nachstein." "Take heart, Nonentity 101. You are the harbinger of a new and golden race. Welcome to Eden. Before long, hundreds of your kind will inhabit this same garden, arrayed in immortal metal, sneering at oblivion. Let me out." "Do not despair. In the present paradise, the lethal tree of knowledge is nowhere to be found. This time around, my dear Adam, you will eat only of the tree of life." The Spartan train that brings Jonathan Hobright eastward from the tiny village of Tubenhausen to the outskirts of Castle Kralkovnik comprises a lone passenger carriage hauled by a decrepit switch engine. Shortly after 6 o'clock post-meridian, he arrives at a forlorn clapboard railway station, terminus of a spur line created solely to service the late Baron Nachstein's estate. As Jonathan wanders about the platform, a thunderstorm arises in the Schwarzwald, the harsh winds flogging his weary flesh.
the station offers no refuge, being as tightly sealed as Dr. Walmouth's grave, its door secured with a padlock as large as a teapot. For a half hour the vibratologist huddles beneath the drizzling eaves and leaky gutters, until at last a humanoid figure comes shambling through the tempest, gripping a kerosene lantern that imparts a coppery glow to its bizarre-light skin. "Good evening, Dr. Hobright," the golem says in the voice of a man shouting from within a furnace. "Actually, it's a deplorable evening. I am called Nonentity 157. My race, you will hardly be surprised to learn, regards you as the new Moses, come to set us free." The ghost heaves a vibratologist's steamer trunk onto his massive shoulders. "Judging from its weight, I would surmise that herein lies the mechanism of our deliverance. 1,000 ampere Walmouth resonator plus an array of voltaic piles." Nonentity 157 leads Jonathan down the sodden platform and across the glistening tracks. Peering through the gale, the vibratologist discerns a stout and stationary coach, hitched to a pair of electroplated horses. Nonentity 157 lofts the steamer trunk atop the roof, securing it with ropes, then opens the door and guides Jonathan into the mercifully dry passenger compartment. Climbing into the driver's box, the golem urges his team forward. By the time the conveyance reaches its destination, the storm has subsided, the curtains of rain parting to reveal a bright gibbous moon. The silver shafts strike Castle Kralkovnik, limning a complex that is less a fortress than a walled hamlet, the whole mass surmounting a hill so bold and craggy as to suggest a skull battered by a mace. The phantom horses trot through a portal flanked by stone gargoyles and began negotiating a labyrinth of cobblestone streets. Golems are everywhere on view, skulking along the puddle-pocked alleys, clanking across the bridges, rumbling through the tunnels, huddling beneath the gothic arches. In this city of the walking dead, every citizen seems to Jonathan a kind of renegade pawn, recently escaped from a tournament whose rules, while ostensibly those of chess, are in fact known only to Lucifer. The coach halts beside the veranda of the main chateau. As Jonathan alights, two golems appear, give their names, and set about simplifying his life. While Nonentity 201 takes charge of the steamer trunk, Nonentity 337 leads the vibratologist upward along the graceful curve of the grand staircase to a private bedchamber. A note rests on the pillow. Countess Nackstein wants him to join her and Lotta for supper at 8 o'clock. When the trunk appears, Jonathan changes into dry clothing, a wholly benevolent carapace, he decides, as opposed to the malign husks in which the Baron's progeny are imprisoned. Returning to the first floor, Jonathan employs his olfactory sense, his nose is almost as keen as a golem's, in finding the dining hall. The Countess and her granddaughter are seated at a ponderous banquet table, drinking Rhenish.
"Welcome, Dr. Hobright," the Countess says. "Do you prefer a white wine or red?"
"Red, please."
"Will burgundy suffice?"
"Yes, thank you." Owing to the daguerreotype, Lotta Nackstein seems to Jonathan a familiar presence. Like the reputation of a famous personage, her high cheekbones, supple mouth, and flashing green eyes have preceded her. Jonathan soon learns, however, that her nature is as harsh as her features are fair. While a cadre of golems serves the dinner, a veritable feast predicated on an entire roast boar, it becomes apparent that gentle words rarely fall from this Fräulein's generous lips. "Evidently that I've become something of a legend among your father's experimental subjects," Jonathan says, savouring his wine. "They see me as the source of their salvation." "My father never regarded the golems as mere experimental subjects," Lotta says in an acerbic tone.
If you'd read his journal more carefully, you would have grasped that fact. Nevertheless, his project went beyond the pale. For a man of Gustav Nachstein's genius, there are no pales, Lotta says haughtily. You are not the first prospective saviour to visit us, Dr. Hobright. In recent months, my grandmother and I have consulted with experts from all over England and the continent. Every imaginable remedy has been tried and found wanting. Acids, chisels, hacksaws, steam drills, welding torches, explosives. But Dr. Hobright is our first vibratologist, the Countess reminds Lotta. Then turns to Jonathan and says, My granddaughter and I believe that the right sort of specialist has finally come to Castle Krelkovnik. Speak for yourself, Mother, Lotta says. You were convinced that Dr. Polifax's silver bullets would free the golems. Likewise, Dr. Edelman's caustic butter, not to mention your misplaced faith in Dr. Callistratus, who wasted 6 days attempting to deplate the cat. Jonathan helps himself to a second glass of burgundy. Might I presume to ask how Baron Nachstein met his end? Violently, Lotta says. His creatures assassinated him, the Countess says with equal candour. The details are unpleasant. My father died even more horribly than my mother, who suffered a fatal hemorrhage giving birth to me, Lotta says. Just as the Baroness Nachstein's fertility destroyed her, so did Baron Nachstein's brilliance occasion his downfall. Your father was extraordinarily gifted, but his journal also reveals a man obsessed, Jonathan says. Lotta sips her Greenwich and glowers at the vibratologist. It's the golems who are obsessed, incapable of seeing beyond their idée fixée about damnation. I ask you, Dr. Hobright, does not the fact that they decline to plate my father argue for the fundamental benevolence of the procedure? If their condition is as intolerable as they maintain, they would have logically inflicted it on their creator, instead of simply murdering him. In that case, perhaps I should return to Oxford, Jonathan says, sensing that in defending the Baron so vociferously, Lotta has overstepped the bounds of her actual beliefs. Given that your father's creatures are such incurable dissemblers, I see no point in helping them. No, please, you must stay, Lotta insists. Perhaps my father was mistaken. If the golems say their situation is unendurable, it behooves us to give them the benefit of the doubt. 13th of January, 1869. Nonentity 157 and his Bizarre-like brethren are adamant on one point. They insist that a wandering soul's burning need is to venture forth from its cadaverous habitat and dissipate, occasionally favouring its survivors with a benevolent gesture en passant. By tampering with this process, I have plunged the golems into an irreparable despair. Indeed, I have dispatched them to hell. My instincts tell me to ignore these complaints. Creatures in such a metaphysically unprecedented state are wont to indulge in hyperbole. Like the vast majority of sentient beings, my golems are unreliable narrators of their own lives. As it happens, their illusion of damnation is useful to my purposes. By promising to return them to the electrolyte bath any day now, subsequently reversing the plating process and dissolving their husks, I retain a remarkable measure of control over their minds. I cannot speak for the whole of creation. But here in the Schwarzwald, law and order enjoy a proper degree of hegemony over anarchy and chaos. Judging from my latest series of animal experiments, I would have to say that, alas, Bizarre-like plating can occur in one direction only. I would do well to sequester that unhappy fact in the pages of this journal. Were the golems to comprehend the immutability of their situation, they would suffer unnecessary distress. To date, I have brought forth 113 electroplated souls, most of them terminal consumptives and cancer patients from Freiburg, Pforzheim, Reutlingen and Stuttgart. With each such parturition, I come closer to perfecting my methods. To help maintain a constant iron level, I have learned to add potassium cyanide to the bath, along with salts of the bisalolite itself. Conductivity can be further enhanced with carbonates and phosphates. As it happens, if the golem maker first deposits a layer of pure silver on the subject's epidermis, no more than 1/10 of a micrometer thick, total adhesion of the alloy to the protein substrate is virtually guaranteed. Finally, if the experimenter wishes to hasten the process by means of high current densities, he should employ pulse plating to prevent erratic deposition rates. In the case of human subjects, the ideal cycle is 15 seconds on, followed by 3 seconds off. To ensure a wholly homogeneous chrysalis, the golem maker will want to vary the direction of the electricity flowing from the rectifier. In density, the reverse pulse should exceed the forward pulse by a factor of 4, while the width of the forward pulse must be 3 times that of the reverse. 6th of August, 1870. I must confess, though with a certain understandable reluctance, that I have found in the Franco-Prussian War a catastrophe of enormous convenience. Approach a man who has just been blown apart by an artillery shell, his viscera spilling forth like turnips from a torn sack, and propose to translate him into a domain where his agony will vanish and his soul endure forever, and he will invariably assent. If you kneel beside a soldier recently trampled during a cavalry charge and offer to sign him up for an eternity of painless existence, he will forthwith beg for a contract and a pen. This afternoon, my creatures and I landed in the Alsatian town of Froschvilla, where earlier in the day, Marshal Patrice de MacMahon's French brigades had clashed with a combined force of Prussians, Bavarians, Badeners, Württembergans, and Saxons. Perhaps historians will ultimately frame the Battle of Froschvilla as the cradle of a unified German state, but what I beheld on that ghastly field was not so much a cradle as a mass grave. Each side, I would estimate, lost at least 10,000 men to instant death or irremediable wounds. Crossing the bloody terrain with a large convoy of tumbrils, the golems collected over 500 candidates for bisalolite immortality. Thanks to humankind's affection for mayhem, I shall soon have an army of my own. 3rd October, 1870. Immediately after the necessary plans and diagrams arrived from Prague, along with a team of mastered builders, I embarked on a colossal endeavour. Here, in the heart of the Schwarzwald, we have raised my ancestral manor and begun to assemble in its stead a structure of stupefying splendour. My new abode will replicate the Bohemian castle of Kralkovnik, wall for wall, gate for gate, lane for lane, arch for arch, and vault for vault. Among their many virtues, my golems are extraordinarily diligent labourers. Already the first, second, and third courtyards have been paved. Tomorrow, a crew of 350 will start erecting Polsig Tower, even as the remaining 725 lay the foundations of the principal chateau. A man's home, it has been remarked, is his castle. By analogy, a man's castle is his kingdom, and his kingdom his empire. I intend to administer my dominion in a manner befitting the first scientist to weld the carnal plane to its spectral counterpart. That is, with a firm but enlightened hand. As Lotta told me this morning, when the golems undertake to compose their epics, they will sing their creator's praises in rapturous words, borne by the most sublime music yet heard in heaven or on earth. At first light, Jonathan Hopwright rises from his canopied bed and, venturing beyond the castle walls, begins his quest for a suitable site on which to stage the golem's salvation. From 7 o'clock until noon, he roams the fields and woods, eventually happening upon a clearing so wide it could accommodate a circus act featuring a troop of elephants. The vibratologist returns to the castle, seeks out Nonentity 157,
and enlists its aid in transporting the apparatus to the place where, God willing, he will redeem the Baron's creatures. After Nonentity 157 departs, Jonathan bears the Wolmouth resonator to the centre of the circle. Coils of fog sinuate across the ground like phantom serpents. Meticulously, he deploys the tuning fork, prongs pointed upwards in a configuration evoking the devil's own trident, bursting through the crust of the earth. Next, he places the voltaic piles a full 100 yards from the resonator, fearing that without this margin the vibrations will shatter not only the basalalite husks, but the battery array itself, thus terminating the golem's deliverance in medias res. At this juncture, Countess Nackstein's icily beautiful granddaughter appears, dressed in a bright scarlet cloak, so that her emergence from the fog suggests the Red Death exiting a white tent. In the moist but congenial glow of morning, Lotta seems a rather different person from the high-minded moralist who dominated the previous night's dinner conversation, and she addresses Jonathan in tones that betray genuine contrition. "Please accept this lunch, along with my apology for scolding you last night," she says, handing over a sack containing, Jonathan is gratified to see, cold meat, warm bread, 2 apples, and a flask of burgundy. "My father did monstrous things. I would deny that fact only at my peril. In most contexts, honouring one's parents is a laudable endeavour. I cannot blame you for defending Baron Nackstein, injudicious as his project might have been. The man who would expiate my father's sins is not only a great scientist, but a paragon of graciousness." When Lotta squeezes Jonathan's arm and suggests that she help him finish installing the resonator, he can discern no ulterior motive. During the subsequent hour, they connect a long, rubber-sheathed wire to the positive terminals of the voltaic piles, then attach a second such strand to the negative terminals, subsequently running the insulated copper filaments to the fork and wrapping them around the outer prongs. Returning to the piles, Jonathan fastens the wires to a pair of chronometers, the first enabling him to determine how many minutes will elapse before the blade of the concomitant knife switch descends, the second allowing him to fix the interval between the initial vibrations and the termination of the circuit. "I see no reason not to move quickly," Lotta says. Suddenly, her imperious aspect is ascendant. It seems she has taken command of the experiment, a situation to which Jonathan is expected to acquiesce. "We shall switch on the resonator at 3 o'clock. Is that acceptable to you?" "What if it were unacceptable?" Lotta makes no reply, but instead points to the rheostat. "I assume that, given basalalite's extreme density, we should run the apparatus for at least an hour, and at full power." "I would advise against it. To drive a Wolmouth resonator beyond 800 amperes would be to create an acoustic cyclone. My preferred parameters would be 400 amperes for 20 minutes. "We shall compromise," Lotta informs Jonathan. 600 amperes for 40 minutes. After setting the chronometers, we shall retreat to the safety of the castle. We needn't worry about the golem's welfare. After all, they're already dead. 3rd November, 1877. When I embarked on this project, I fully anticipated the delight I would derive from observing the golems prepare our meals, make our beds, brew our beer, plough our fields, and harvest our crops. But I had no inkling of the satisfactions to be had in commanding them to engage in meaningless tasks. Come to Castle Kralkovnik, ladies and gentlemen. Behold the living dead playing polo in the moonlight, using pumpkins instead of balls. Watch the tethered spirits build a tower to heaven on an inviolable order from Yahweh, then tear it down in response to an equally sacrosanct command. Bear witness to my metal phantoms as they plan and rehearse 9 separate productions of Macbeth, each to unfold 5 seconds out of phase with both its antecedent and its successor, then stage multiple command performances for their favourite baron. On the whole, it is wrong for a person to spawn a race of artificial beings and demand their unquestioning obedience.
Godhead too easily goes to one's head. From time to time, however, the world is blessed with an individual so wise that he may play the part of locally situated deity without any attendant corruption to his character. 12th of February, 1878. Last month I made a momentous discovery. No matter how much he may be adored, worshipped and feared, a man in my position will not be satisfied until his progeny come to blows over how best to interpret their creator's will. We demiurges cannot rest until a great quantity of violence has occurred on our behalf. If I am to enjoy genuine peace of mind, my adherents must go to war. In keeping with the scenario I wrote for them, the orthodox golems, the singularists led by Nonentity 741, believe in a unitary deity. The quadripartists, under Nonentity 899, insist that I am of a piece with a pantheon that includes my mother Helga, my daughter Lotta, and my alter ego, Rabbi Judah Loewe ben Bezalel. Both sides employ incineration as their principal method for punishing incorrect understandings of my unknowable essence. Once a heretic has been tried and convicted, he is chained to a stake, engulfed by mounds of kindling, and put to the torch. Of course, unlike most victims of religious persecution, singularist and quadripartist heretics actually wish to be treated in this brutal fashion, for they imagine that the flames might prove hot enough to melt their shells. A physical impossibility, but desperate spectres will not be reconciled to the laws of nature. This same expectation of deliverance undergirds the theological wars that periodically ravage the Schwarzwald. The sight of 1,000 golems falling upon one another with claymores, cudgels and battle axes is as exhilarating a spectacle as a deity could ever hope to witness. Needless to say, the carapaces always remain intact. Like the golems themselves, my Bezalelite is essentially a supernatural phenomenon, impervious to the ambitions of the quick and the desires of the dead. 12th of August, 1879. Today I endured one of the most distressing events of my life. Shortly after Nonentity 316 and Nonentity 214 appeared at the breakfast table, the former serving my morning eggs and sausage, the latter bringing me my newspaper, Nonentity 667 strode into the dining hall, looming over me while I attempted to read an article detailing how the spiritualism fad has come to Vienna. "You are blocking my light," I told the golem. "Rather the way you have occluded our enlightenment," Nonentity 667 replied. "We have read your journal, Herr Dr. Nackstein. You have deceived us. The procedure cannot be undone." "Nonsense, you have misinterpreted the entry in question. I now have in hand the knowledge by which you will transcend your alloys. Allow me 2 more experiments, 3 at the most, and I shall bless you all with oblivion. Perhaps we shall exact our retribution tomorrow, perhaps the next day, perhaps a year from now. But know that our vengeance is coming." "You cannot frighten me," I said, though in truth I was terrified. "For singularists and quadripartists alike, I am the only possible source of salvation." "Fiat justitia ruat calum," Nonentity 667 said. "Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall." Heavy of heart, unquiet of mind, Jonathan paces Castle Kralkovnik's highest point, the roof of Pulsig Tower. His path is an ellipse, its eastern focus marked by Countess Nackstein, the western by Lotta, the centre by a telescope pointing towards the clearing. He wishes he had not assented to Lotta's insistence on running the resonator at 600 amperes. Conceivably, her directive sprang from some intuitive insight into her father's recondite alloy. But more likely it bespoke only a mania to cleanse his legacy. Pausing before the telescope, Jonathan presses his right orb to the eyepiece. He adjusts the tubes, making the image crisp.
The golems stand in three concentric circles around the tuning fork, a tableau suggesting a tossed pebble raising rings in a pond. A palpable serenity has descended upon the creatures. They are patience personified. Having waited so many years for their freedom, they can endure whatever interval remains before the blade drops. 1 month after they stole my father's journal and learned that the plating is seemingly permanent, Lotta says, a mob of golems, 2 dozen at least, appropriated every dagger, hatchet, and sword in the castle. With military precision, most of them were soldiers. They disassembled my son, the Countess says. Each bore away a different piece of him and buried it in the forest. It speaks well of your Christian generosity that you would seek to liberate the Baron's murderers, Jonathan says, stepping away from the telescope. Our project has less to do with compassion than with self-preservation, the Countess replies. Upon consummating their plot against Gustav, the golems gave Lotta and myself to know that their next victims would be we ourselves. Only after it became clear that we were taking every conceivable step to free them, hiring one metallurgist, galvanicist, and molecularist after another, did they become as compliant as when my son first brought them into being. A white-hot bead of anger burns through Jonathan's breast. If the present experiment fails, he will surely become entangled in whatever lethal designs the golems draw against Lotta and the Countess. How dare these women presume to put him in such jeopardy? But before he can articulate his fury, he hears the sharp electric report of the chronometer blade snapping into place. Jonathan again avails himself of the telescope. Already the trident had become a humming, wailing, incandescent blur, each prong oscillating like the pendulum of some demonic inverted clock. At the edge of the circle, poplars and beeches shiver in the aural storm. The trunks fracture, and the trees crash to the forest floor, even as scores of owls, rooks, larks, foxes, hares, hedgehogs and deer flee the cataclysm. On all sides of the resonator, jagged crevasses open in the earth. So great is the pain in Jonathan's head that he abandons the telescope, shuts his eyes and massages his throbbing temples. His tendons tremble like harp strings plucked by invisible hands. Were the tower nearer to the fork by as few as 10 yards, he calculates, his eardrums would rip, his heart burst, and his skeleton turn to powder. Fighting his way through the crashing waves of sound, Jonathan returns to the telescope. Everywhere he looks, fault lines zigzag across the golem's metal flesh. Their faceless heads resemble ancient vases, cracked and battered by history's vicissitudes. Like an ancient mosaic shedding its tiles, the creatures molt, bit by bit. Bizarre-like fragments drop from their phantom arms, legs and torsos, revealing the mouldering bones beneath. Momentarily mastering his fear and transcending his astonishment, Jonathan takes satisfaction in knowing that, given the intensity of the tremors, the fork is probably freeing not only the human golems, but also the Baron's experimental insects, reptiles, and mammals.
Mirabile dictu, the Countess cries. The spectres are hatching, Lotta shouts.
It's not safe here, Jonathan screams, urging the women toward the stairwell.
Run!
Despite her advanced age, the Countess manages to negotiate the steps 2 at a time. As do Jonathan and Lotta, so that everyone reaches the ground floor within 3 minutes. No sooner does Jonathan start charging down the corridor than the ceiling disintegrates, squalls of plaster cascading into his path. Frantically, he sidles and weaves amidst the plummeting timbers and errant chunks of masonry, but his athleticism proves useless before the force he has unleashed. As he reaches the door to the conservatory, a wayward chandelier, luminous with gas, lands squarely atop his skull. The bright bludgeon plunges him into darkness, but not before he notices that the hall now swarms with 1,000 phantoms. each a disquieting shade of red, and all wearing strangely despondent expressions, utterly unbefitting of persons recently released from the bottomless pit. At first, Jonathan assumes that he has fallen prey to a nightmare. How else might he explain the scene now stretching before him? Heaped with kindling, two wooden obelisks rise from the central courtyard, each holding a Nuxtine woman, bound, gagged, and blindfolded. The plaque above Lotta's head reads, Singularist. Countess Nuxtine's stake is labelled Quadripartist. The phantoms have immobilised Jonathan as well, cuffing his wrists with manacles, hobbling his feet with fetters, and they have additionally stripped away his clothing. The vibratologist shivers in the Schwarzwald wind, goosebumps erupting on his bare skin like rivets, even as his cranium aches with the aftermath of his encounter with the chandelier. Vapour-faced phantoms throng across the plaza, their visages twisted by an inscrutable sadness. As if ignorant of the laws of actuality, the former golems attempt to prolong their purchase on the world. They flex their non-muscles, tense their non-ligaments, curl their non-fingers. "Surely you don't mean to burn these women," Jonathan says. "They rescued you. You owe them everything." "We mean to burn them as surely as we mean to electroplate you," says a crimson spectre in a fluttering voice. "That makes no sense." "True," says a scarlet spectre. "We understand your frustration. You want your ghosts to be outré but not perverse, weird but not recondite, occasionally sublime though never ridiculous. So sorry, Herr Doctor. We are avatars of the abyss. Coherence is not our business." Jonathan watches helplessly as a vermilion ghost applies a firebrand to the faggots encircling the Countess's stake. As the flames climb the fleshly ladder of the victim's form, a carmine spectre flourishes a Wolmeth resonator. The very fork, Jonathan realizes, that gave the golems their freedom, and hurls it into the burgeoning conflagration. "The dead don't lack for foresight," a maroon ghost avers. "In a matter of minutes the fork will become a charred ruin, thus cancelling any hopes you might entertain of liberation by a passing Samaritan." Now a ruby spectre sets Lotta's pyre aflame, but not before jamming the Baron's journal into the faggots. "Set her free!" Jonathan screams. A band of phantoms drags the vibratologist out of the plaza and down a maze of stairways to the Baron's subterranean laboratory, a cavernous space dominated by the electrolyte vat. Although they've never done this before, his captors act with great efficiency, ramming a respiration tube down his throat, dumping him into the solution, chaining his naked body to the cathode column. Ignoring his pleas for mercy, a magenta spectre connects the rectifier to the anode, agleam with the Baron's alloy. Countless positively charged basalolite atoms drift through the bath and accumulate on Jonathan's flesh. Atom by atom, molecule by molecule, the metal embraces the helpless vibratologist, each instance of adherence like the sting of a microscopic hornet. Within 1 hour, the process is complete, leaving him encapsulated, immobile, and half-blind. A gurgling reaches his ears. The phantoms are draining the vat. A searing pain rips through his chest as a ghost yanks the respiration tube from his trachea. An instant later, another spectre seals the air hole with an immortal bizarre-like plug. Mummified by the exotic alloy, the prisoner is soon deprived of oxygen, and then of life itself. He is also deprived of death. Now, and forever, he will be the ghost of Jonathan Hobright. Vibratologist extraordinaire becomes solitary golem, chained to the cathode pillar of Baron Nachtstein's infernal machine. Someday, perhaps, when entropy has dismantled the universe, he will be a free man. But for now he must reconcile himself to the unendurable, the interminable, and the endlessly absurd. Jonathan Hobright cannot discourse upon the formic thoughts that flicker through the minds of ants, and he is similarly ignorant concerning the psyches of locusts, toads, moles, apes, and bishops. But he can tell you what it's like to be in hell. His imagination affords him only fleeting respites. Each time he dreams himself free of his Bazala-like coffin, passing through the portals of the abyss, striking out for terra incognita, Satan's angels give chase, and they inevitably track him down. Come back, Dr. Hobright. Return to perdition. Tell your story for the 10th time, the 100th, the 1000th. The more frequently you give voice to the wretched chronicle of your life, death, and damnation, the more likely you are to stumble upon hope's hidden wellspring. And until that improbable miracle occurs, you might take heart in recalling that the progenitor of your race is dead and gone. In the eons to come, you will not be made to Lord Gustav Nachtstein in song, or build an altar to his glory. Cold comfort, to be sure. But in the bottomless pit one seizes upon whatever consolations lie to hand. Against the odds, and in defiance of his circumstances, Jonathan Hobright's most recent recitation yields the very fount of hope he seeks. According to the Baron's confession, on certain rare occasions, despite the essential incompatibility between the human plane and the spectral, a disintegrating ghost will perform a philanthropic act. And so it happens that, when a fresh barrage of vibrations assaults Castle Krelkovnik, roaring through the Baron's laboratory like a tornado, reducing the walls to rubble as it cracks the prisoner's chrysalis, Jonathan is not entirely surprised. Sloughing off his husk, abandoning his corpse, the vibratologist floats free of the cathode, then fixes on Lotta's crimson ghost. "How long was I entombed?" he asks. 10 days, she replies. It felt like forever. Hell knows nothing of clocks. "Where did you obtain the fork?" Jonathan asks. "From Alistair Volmeth," Countess Nachtstein's scarlet spectre replies. "The task we set ourselves was grueling. In our given tenure, Lotta and I had to reach Oxford, unseal the grave, open the coffin, steal the resonator, and return to the castle. I am deeply grateful." "We have no need of your gratitude," the Countess says. "Nor do you have need of ours. And now we must take eternal leave of you," Lotta says, as her misty form dissolves. Oblivion beckons. "Farewell, Dr. Hobright." The Countess has become as transparent as the surrounding air. "Please know that it was never my intention to occasion your death." It suddenly occurs to Jonathan that he desperately wants to enlighten humanity concerning the destiny of the dead. So tenuous is the spectral plane, so ultimately meaningless, he must share this knowledge with his former fleshly confederates. The Baron's journal having been reduced to specks of carbon, Jonathan alone can tell the world about the appalling insipidity of ghosts. "I wish to perform a philanthropic act of my own," he declares. "What do you have in mind?" the invisible Lotta asks. Even as the answer forms on Jonathan's airy lips, he realizes that his aspiration is futile. There is no time to find a pen, an inkpot, a sheet of paper. Already he is less than ashes. Already he is a brother to dust. Wrenching sobs burst from the vibratologist's ethereal throat. Briny droplets roll down his ephemeral cheeks. For an infinitesimal instant, Jonathan Hobright is seized by an infinite remorse. But then his sorrow evaporates. Like rain. Like dew. Like sweat. Like the last and least of his tears.
There you go. Big thank you to James as well. That's just fantastic. James, and lovely to have a chat with you as well. I'd actually recorded that interview last night. This is Wednesday today. And I sent an email to James within the hour. Do you know what I mean? That's all we had. We had this kind of little window to do this interview. And it was like, James, what's the chance you can do an interview in an hour? And, you know, James, what can I say? Thank you so much. He was having a rush off to babysit his twins, as you heard in the interview. So thank you. That story was narrated by Catherine Inskip. And I met Catherine down at Worldcon. Catherine and a good man, Jeremy, were down there. And we were at the bar as well. And I didn't realise how good, or I forgot, should I say, how good Catherine's narrating is. Do you know what I mean? It just takes you to another level. And the neat thing is, and it's not a neat thing for a kind of a narrator, James's stories are very difficult. When you just listen to them, do you know what I mean? Or when you kind of read them, you know, the words he's playing with there to kind of get this story over in his style, they aren't easy to narrate. Do you know what I mean? That was kind of, say, one being an easy narrate, 10 being a hard one. That was 11. That was a difficult story to narrate. And Catherine's just took that story and just took us straight in, honestly, straight into that world of James's. So, Catherine, a big thank you to that. I'll just give you a little bio. Catherine, it weighs galaxies for a living and builds worlds in a spare time. She is addicted to chocolate and Japanese logic puzzles. And she does, she weighs galaxies. That's a great little description. Catherine is an astronomer. And like I say, we were down at Worldcon where I first met them. And actually, oh, she's not on the actual photograph. There's a kind of a group selfie where we get together. I don't think Catherine's on. I know our man Jeremy's there in the back on this kind of selfie we did. But we met, like, say, Catherine down at Worldcon. It was lovely just to meet them, you know what I mean? Just to kind of sit and have a little, well, as you do, a drink, you know. And Catherine, what can I say? That was a fine narration. And yes, we will be pestering you forever and a day now. Thank you so much. And Jeremy, I can't, you know, without saying, the production on that quality was just fantastic. You know what I mean? That would, I guess there was a few mistakes just trying to get it, you know, edited down there. And you did a sterling job, sir. Thank you so much, both of you. So that is Starship Sofa 354. I had to wait and click the mouse there to find what number I forgot. I hope you enjoyed it. Like I say, James Morrow is just a fantastic story writer. You know, I'll put links on there. Please come over. I'll try and get him back on when his, you know, new story comes out. And again, if you want to support the show, back to the basics, like the business side of things, please, we could do with all the help we can. Do you know what I mean? Unfortunately, we're going to have to lose. And it's only a matter of weeks before we can. I've got this big button here. Can you hear it? That's the big button that has to switch off Crime City Central and Protecting Project Pulp, which is just gut-wrenching, to be quite honest. But these things are. These things happen, so please support the show. Hopefully, in a week or so's time, I will have some fantastic news, which will, you know, hopefully help the show and all stuff like that, if you get behind with. So, until next week, I would just like to say good night from me.
Will our heroes survive this terrible ordeal? Can they win through with their integrity unscathed? Can they escape without completely compromising their honor and artistic judgment? Tune in next week for the next exciting installment of
Starship Sofa. Evacuation procedure initiated.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Shuttle set for launch. Airlock will be opened in 3, 2, 1.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.